Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for Autumn Semester 2022.
Financial markets and institutions. The first thing we're going to do, as always, is we are going to look at screens. And the screens we're looking at are, of course, obviously, the stock market screens, commodity screens, and bond markets. Now, I already talked to you. What kind of a day is this? Ma'am, is this a bear day or a bull day? Bear day. You say it's a bear day. Why do you say it's a bear day? Let's fine tune that. Okay. Are the numbers green or red? And that means that stock prices are going. Don't whisper. Be bold. Yeah, be bold. You know, if you're wrong, I'll just say, God, that was wrong. No. They're going down. We have a bear day underway. This one's a little bit trickier for us here. You, madam, is it a significant bear day, or is it a kind of a tepid bear day? In other words, is it a Kodiak Alaskan bear, or is it Yogi Bear, smarter than the average bear? Oh, shut up. Say what? No, it's insignificant because those numbers, this is a Yogi Day. Gee, Mr. Ranger, you know, you remember Yogi Bear?
Not really.
Oh, you don't remember the picnic basket and Mr. Ranger's going to get us boo-boo? The boo-boo was, oh, the hell was it? Okay, remember I said that when you, you are old enough, you know what I'm talking about. Okay. The thing here is that when you got a point below 0.3, 0.2, either way, up or down, that's not a significant movement. And remember, we look only at the percentages. The numbers really don't mean anything to us because that's comparing apples and oranges. The NASDAQ is measured in 12,000. The Dow is in 32,000, S&P is in 4,000. So the numbers themselves, the dollar amounts, aren't what you need to look at. You need to look at the percentages. And all those percentages are kind of like tepid. The Dow and the Standard & Poor's 500, Dow 30 and the Standard & Poor's 500, are both down only a little bit, and they're very similar. There's negative information, but it's not hard, bad information. And notice that all the markets are trying to recover. See those spark charts? The bears slapped it down at the beginning and in the mid-morning. They were hard. And then the bulls are trying to crawl back out from where they were knocked down. You see how there are all these indices, numbers, the spark charts are crawling back toward the zero right now. That means that whatever that bad news is, some good news is kind of countering it at this point. What had happened was that yesterday, the Federal Reserve, their big dog, the chairman, doubled down on increasing interest rates. In other words, they are not messing around with this inflation problem. They're going to claw back the liquidity, in other words, contract the supply of money. The price of money is interest rates. So if the money supply is being brought down, the price of money, interest rates, is going up. As interest rates go up, that hurts businesses, that hurts consumers. That will slow down the economy. That's why these numbers were horribly negative yesterday. And even this morning, there was some more, you know, kind of negative news in the early morning, and toward the mid-morning, there was some more negative news. But since then, the markets have heard some good news, and that's helping them go back up. The market does not do what it does capriciously, and it does not remember anything. It's already happened. Yesterday, the Fed said some hurtful things. The market reacted. Today, that means nothing to where the prices are going to go from here, because it's already been impounded, as we say, in the prices yesterday. So what happens now is what is actually happening out there in the world now. The history does not matter to stock prices, not at all. We don't work that way. Now, again, I'm going to emphasize this one more time here, is that, and this is chapter two where we are today, is that only one of those numbers is an actual exchange. That's the NASDAQ. It is a full-blown, vast electronic exchange. There's no trading floor, but it is many, many tens of thousands of stocks. Most of the NASDAQ stocks are small cap, small capitalization. I'll talk more about that over the next couple of days. But those companies are small. They're scrappy. They're high risk, high expected return. You invest in those if you are a risk-taking kind of person. The NASDAQ would be the one you would look most at. Notice how the Dow and the S&P 500 are much less reactive. Those are larger companies. It takes a larger missile to make those companies ships rock in the ocean. So those, you're not going to see them move. Most days, they're not going to move as much as the NASDAQ is, up or down. They'll still react to the same forces, but not at the same scale. Sometimes you'll see the Dow and the S&P 500 drop large and the NASDAQ barely moves, or the S&P 500 and the Dow will shoot up a lot and the NASDAQ won't move. That's not too common, but that would simply mean that the news was more positive or negative, whatever, for larger companies than for small companies. Okay, now remember, those other ones, if you see a number after it, it is not an exchange. It's merely a theoretical portfolio of a certain number of stocks. The Dow 30 is a theoretical portfolio of the 30 largest companies on Earth. It tells you what the giants are doing. Well, they may not be the largest, but they're enormous. Now, it used to be called the Dow Industrials, because it was all the giant industrials of the earth. But as the economies of the world have moved more towards services and entertainment, you see that there are the industrials have been taken off the Dow 30, and they have been replaced with more service-oriented companies, entertainment companies. Disney is in the Dow 30, I believe, which is kind of hilarious. I think the original founders of the Dow would have had a heart attack if they'd known that a Mickey Mouse operation was part of the Dow 30, but there's that. Again, the Standard & Poor's 500 is 500 of the largest companies in the world. They are monopolistic competitors, almost all of them. In other words, in the short term, they try to hold monopoly position in their goods and services. In the long run, they drift into competitive arrangements in those goods and services. The Russell 2000, like I said, there are so many of these indexes, as we call them. The Russell 2000 is sort of like a hodgepodge of 2,000 companies. And they say, okay, what would that portfolio do? Well, that portfolio of those 2,000 companies right now would be down about 0.38% for the day. It's hard to read a lot of these indexes because, there's things like the Wilshire 500 and this, that, and the other thing. And there are a couple of reasons why you want to be a little careful with those. For one thing, they are oftentimes just sort of a hodgepodge of companies. They're not telling you anything really significant about the overall world or the overall economic outlook of the country or anything like that. They're just a portfolio that some people like, and they won't follow it. Others of these indices, as it used to be called, are industries. Like you'll find an index that is one for the healthcare industry, a portfolio of companies that are all in healthcare, or all in green energy, or all in oil and gas production, or all in something or other. So sometimes these are of interest, especially if you work in that industry or you're a specialist in the analysis of that industry. You might follow one of those indices. But overall, these ones with a number after them, they don't represent actual exchanges. It's important, and the book goes into this in detail too, is that your big ones in the United States are the Dow 30, the S&P 500, the exchanges, the biggest one is the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE. Remember that if you see one, two, or three letter symbol, that's probably an NYSE company. If you see four letters, that is a NASDAQ company. Or it might, sometimes a NASDAQ will get so big that it will move over to the New York Stock Exchange, in which case, once in a while, you'll see a four-letter company that's an NYSC. But for the most part, the 1-2-3-4 rule applies. So if I were to give you a company like PFE, Pfizer, that's three letters, that'd be an NYSE company. It might also be, it might otherwise be, another big exchange in the United States is called the AMEX, the American Exchange. They are both physical platforms. There is a place where the traders go to do the deals. When you call and you say, I want, I would like to purchase one round lot, that would be 100 shares. You call your broker, say, I would like to purchase one round lot of K at market. That would mean that you are K, Kellogg, one letter, New York Stock Exchange. Your broker would put in an order to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Now, the way it works is there are people out around the, you see that screaming and all that, you don't see. All around are these runners. They take the order from the phone or from cell phones now, and they will send a signal to the trader that is actually in the pit somewhere. And those hand signals are changing every hour or so, so that no broker or trader or anything like that can read another company's or trader's signals. And they might do like that for a K, one round lot at market, and that might change to 1K at market in an hour. And then he goes to a place where he can make that trade for 100 shares. And it's at the market, so he'll buy at whatever price there is. And you're stupid if you ever put in a market at an order at market, because you don't know what price they're going to get. Usually you'll put in a limit. You'll give them, okay, I want 25 or better. In other words, if you can't get me 25, don't do it. Or you can say a fill or kill, 25 fill or kill. At 25, if you can't do it right away, just drop the order. Or 25, good till canceled. In other words, try to get 25 until I say stop. Or 25, good for the day. And then that means that they'll try to get 25 at whenever they can during the day. Now at 100, you might say, go up to the trader, I want 100 right now, 25 or better. You got it? And someone says, I got 20, I'll do 25 for 50 of the shares. And then someone will say, I got 20 of those shares. You got to remember that as a trader. Put together the order, fill out the paperwork somewhere along the line, and then go back, and it's done. Confirmation goes, you got your order. Now, some of this is electronic now, but a lot of it is still old school, the open cry, yelling at each other to get things done. It's a exciting AF, but you can burn out real fast in that world. Yeah. Yeah, because I can't hack a broker, right? See, I mean, there are, you know, we don't trust people. It's just something. You know, I don't trust you, okay? I'm sorry. But you see, with this kind of a system, it's still robust, and there's also, I mean, they've got AIs that can do a lot of this now. It's not really artificial intelligence. Like I said, that's still 3 to 5. But fast machine learning can do a lot of this now. The funniest, hilarious, there was a couple of, oh, it's been like 4 or 5 years ago. I was running the Illinois State Students in Finance. And I took them up to places in Chicago to have presentations so that they could get to know corporate executives, get their resumes in front of them, maybe get jobs, hear the wisdom of these top dogs and all of this kind of stuff. And this new professor said, I've made arrangements for them to go to the Chicago Board of Trade, the CBOT. And boy, that's going to be a wild day. I said, you wanted to take them to the Chicago Board of Trade? Yeah. Okay. So I just kind of tagged along. And they went into this vast building up there in Chicago, you know, where all the things like hog bellies, wheat, oils of different grades, all that's traded. It was an insane place in the back in the day. And so the people who run it were real excited. We'd love to have you come in. Welcome to our place. And they gave them a quick primer on the whole thing about open cry systems and how it works with commodities trading. And we went to the floor, the pits. And there's one for each of the different commodities, just literally dozens and dozens of pits. And all around are the stadium seats for the observers. And all across, all lights were swirling. And the place was dead. Middle of the day, dead. There was only one pit operating. Why? Because all of the other pits had been automated. There were no traders. There didn't have to be. There were traders there. They were sitting in the stadium seats playing on their computers. The only pit that was still open was the options pit, because options are so weird that the computers still can't figure out what we do with them. But yeah, some of it is automated. It was a really disappointing day. They thought they were going to see all this wild, crazy screaming. And there was only one pit where it was happening, and they were pretty polite compared to what they used to be back in my time. But yeah. Okay, so now, oil. We got a commodity. The commodity is up a little bit today. Now, that should mean the gasoline prices are going to start to show signs of upward movement. I don't think so. Based on what I was checking on this weekend, it looks like there is an awful lot of gasoline now in the pipeline. And so even though the price of oil is going up, its products that come from it are actually, they've made so much of it that we'll probably see gasoline prices stay low for some time. There is a lag in the system between what happens when the pump jacks pull it out of the ground and when the pump puts it into your car. So many steps have to go through that process that you can have supply surges and supply depletions in the line, but you don't see the reaction at the gas pumps right away. And it looks kind of weird when that happens. Well, someone's manipulating the price of gas. You know, I saw that the oil was going down in price, but gasoline is going up in price. Well, that's because the oil has not gotten on the ships to move it into the pipes to get it to the refineries, from the pipes back to the ships to get it to the gasoline stations and all that, or the trucks and all that to get to the gasoline stations. So you can see these lags happen. But rest assured, if crude oil keeps going up in price, eventually, maybe 3 days, maybe a week, gas prices will go up. Although that's not guaranteed, because oil prices could sag back down. They're still a hell of a lot lower than they were months ago when you saw $125 a barrel. So, here are two other commodities, gold and silver. Gold and silver have their own dynamics. Every commodity has its own behaviors. So gold is oftentimes driven by speculation of people who have nothing to do with gold. They just buy it and sell it to try to make a buck, or because they're trying to prepare for the zombie apocalypse. As I told you last week, silver is more driven by supply and demand dynamics within the industries that use silver. Industrial silver, cosmetic silver, and all that. So they will tend to move not the same, although you can see today that their patterns are similar. See the spark charts, how they're both moving in the same kind of way over time? Now that's kind of odd. Usually they kind of have their own mind, but today, they seem to be moving the same way. Now, as I told you in the lecture last week, bonds, what you're seeing there, are not the prices. You're seeing the yields. Not the prices, you're seeing the yields. The prices are exactly opposite moving. Perfect inverse relationship. So if I see the yields going up, I see the prices going down. So in other words, are people, more investors, getting out of bonds than going into bonds. The bad news is, see those bond yields? That's reflecting the interest rate increases that the Fed is pushing through. It's having an impact across the debt paper lines. Again, later in the course, I'll talk about currencies. This is the Great Britain pound against the dollar. And then you've got the Japanese yen against the dollar. And then you've got, that's the cryptos, which I'll talk about later. Financial Times, that's a 100. That's an index of 100 large British companies, their stocks. And in this case, as you can see, it's been sagging. And are they closed? No, yeah, they're closed. The London closed just a couple of hours ago. And so you saw that at the end, the bears had taken over and they had smacked it down into negative territory by the end of the day. So London was in a pissy mood. When the sun rose over here, we were in a bad mood too. Notice the strange thing about the Nikkei. The Nikkei started the, and now it's night, it's middle of the night over there now. But during the trading day over there, it started out really negative. I mean hard negative. That's 2.2, that's 2 2/3% down. And then it just floated. So in other words, there was some bad news that started the trading, but there wasn't anything that happened after that. So it just stayed where it was. It's actually Newton's one of Newton's laws of motion. An object in rectilinear motion tends to stay in that path unless it's acted upon by another force. That's what happened here. Something drove it down, a force drove it down, but from there, it stayed along that path. It stayed right along the inertial path that it had been before after the bad news came through. Nothing more happened. Maybe there was a little blip there at the end, but really not much. And so that's how markets work. They are pushed up and down by new information. Old information doesn't make them go anywhere. Oh, a mother's work is never done. Now I'm going to pull up a stock, and I'm going to see if I can find something. Well, I did Kellogg. Now, Kellogg is operating against the market right now. It's up some. Actually, you see how Kellogg, the bulls pulled it up early in trading. And then there hasn't been much more good news, but the bulls seem to have had something make them happy there. So this is pretty much random noise through here, ups and downs and ups and downs. This was something more significant. Now, if I look over here, yesterday at the end of the trading day, when the bell rang, ding, 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 at 3:30 our time, it closed at 73.60. When the market opened this morning, ding, 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 at 8 o'clock a.m. our time, is that it? No, 8:30 our time. I'm getting all times wrong. Whoa, look at that. Yes, I'm sorry. It closed yesterday at 73.85, and this morning it closed down at 73.60. So in other words, in the aftermarket and in the pre-market, more sell than buy orders came in. So when it opened, it looked like it just magically dropped. That was the result of the after and pre-market activity, which pushed it down a little bit. Now remember the bid and the ask. The ask is what you will pay for it. If you put in an order for a share of Kellogg right now, you would pay $74.39. if you were selling a share right now, you would pay, you would get $74.35. That's the bid-ask spread. It's just there. The tighter that spread, the more active the stock is, as a general rule. You really want to be careful if that bid-ask spread is really wide, because essentially you're buying into a pit. Like if that bid were $74.20, you would have just spent $74.39, and instantly the value of your portfolio would be $74.20. So you're climbing out of a pit. Whenever you buy, that price up there at the top, we just use that as our for example. What matters to the buyers and sellers is the bid and the ask. And that, you, like I said, you really, okay, this morning, I took a position in an option. It was a bear option, and it was a bad choice on my part. As it, so far today, it sucked because the market is climbing out of, but I the bid ask spread, what was it? It was 79 cents per it was $79 per contract on the ask, and the bid was $78.50. So instantly I had lost money the instant that transaction happened. Instantly. And then it went down from there, damn it. But anyway. Okay. So anyway, the day's range, 73.24, that would be this pit right here. See it, 73.24? And the high for the day was 74.54. That would have been up here, somewhere around here. That's the day's range. Now, if we look out at the one-year chart, over the last 52 weeks, it has been as low as 59.54. That would have been that pit right there. And it's been as high as 76.99. up there. As you can see, as of right now, it's closer to its 52-week high than its 52-week low. I mean, what does that mean? You know, it's hard to say. But it does seem to have a neckline up there, I don't know, around it seems to have a neckline right there at about $77. Some traders, we call them technical analysts. We informally, kind of derisively, call them elves. The elves would say, if it breaks through 77 on its third run at it, that's a definite buy signal. So in other words, it's going to test that $77 a share wall, and it will bounce off. If it makes it through it within three runs at it, the elves would say that's a buy, because it's shown that it can punch through a previous high. Take that for what it's worth. And I caution you, I am not giving you investment advice, for God's sake. If I was that good at investing, I would not be I would teach you anyway, because I love you. Not. Okay. Okay, now look at the volume here is the volume today. And then the average volume is the volume on average over the last 52 weeks per day. So is this a heavy trading day? Ouch, I almost hurt something I care about. That hurt. God. Boy, someone's going to be pissed. Make sure I'm still on. Can you still hear me? Good. God, that was a pretty dangerous. Anyway, okay. Where the hell am I? Oh, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm fine. You know, even if I got blood on me. You know, remember the famous line by Jesse Ventura in the original Predator? You're bleeding. I ain't got time to bleed. Would you say that this is a light trading day or a heavy trading day? Looking at those two volume numbers there. It's light. Because on an average day, it trades 2.6 million shares. Today, we're almost at the end of the day, and it hasn't traded a million shares yet. So it's a light trading day. Troubling is when you see too many of those light trading days. That usually tells us that the heavies are staying away here a little bit. Another thing that I want to caution you about in this, and older versions of your textbook mentioned this, and I don't know that this newest one does. You see that average volume there? Or even the volume. Those are actually called OBVs, on balance volumes. The way it works, I'll give you the example back when it was all done on paper. Every time a trade, a buy or a sell came in, you had a line in your limit order book, we called it. How many shares was one of the lines is being bought or sold? Now, at the end of the day, you would add up that column of how many shares were bought or sold, all those numbers, and that would be the trading volume for all the books of all the traders, and that would be the volume, on balance volume, the balance sheet. You add up the number of shares. And there was another line that had to match that one, too, another column that had to match that. Okay, that's fine, on balance volume. It has started many, many years ago, but it was very small back then. Now it is scary. The dark markets, where trades happen that aren't on the limit order book. So when I see this, these are official, on the limit order book trades. The balance sheet, as it were, trades. The dark market is where larger and larger amounts of trading are occurring where it cannot be seen, where it is not transparent. And this is done for a number of reasons. Is it legal? Sort of. But then again, this is the internet. Large family fortunes, trust funds, might trade at least some of the time in the dark markets. Prop houses. These are a weird thing, and they're all over the place, and you've probably driven by prop houses and you had no idea what they are. They're simply a place that looks like a normal house, and yet there are a group of professional, hardcore, nasty, greedy traders working in there. You have no idea. It's not just a regular place, but it isn't. Prop houses. Then there are other places where this, even the large known brokers will have accounts that work in the dark markets. They are for the purpose of keeping the wrong people from noticing what you're doing, or making sure that if it's a trade that you don't want the normal traders to react to, you might do it in one of the darks. So this on balance volume, what you see here, doesn't tell you the whole story. And as time is going along, it's telling you less and less of the whole story. What can happen is that a transaction can originate, a significant one, in a dark market. But then the second part of the transaction, where it goes the opposite way, happens in the open market, and suddenly you say, what the hell happened there? Where did all that stock come from? Because the original transaction happened underground, and then the second transaction happened pop out here. And so you suddenly, wow, I didn't see that coming. How did that stock get there? Come out like that. So keep that in mind, that there are other markets. And if you're interested in that, I can talk to you about it. But you've got to be careful, because you're starting to step into the dark web. That's not the deep web. This isn't, you know, hiring assassins and looking at naughty things that are illegal. This is just the dark web. And even there, it's not a place for beginners to start. But if you're interested in it, I'll show it to you sometime. Because basically, I need some sacrifices to give to the big people. Okay, now, the market cap. And this, by the way, is all part of the lecture today. This is the number of shares of the company times the price per share. It is the market's measurement of the total shareholders' equity. It is the market's measure of the total shareholder equity. Now I'm going to pull up something, and I'm just going to sneak in here. I'm not going to tell you much about it. Is there some reason why I can't type? Okay. This should have been shown. I unplugged my ruh-roh. I unplugged the keyboard. Yeah, I'm glad I plugged that back in. Those guys down in IT, they might come up and kick my shin. Well, it's in my podcast, but I can edit that son of a bitch. Okay, you should have been shown this in Business 100. I find it's kind of spotty how much is emphasized about this. Now, I teach Business 100. They got so desperate they brought me back. Apparently, they didn't like the way I corrupted the kids. But I emphasize these SEC documents are just gold. Gold mines for research papers because it's original. And this is the company's filings with the SEC. And the SEC requires anymore that the officers and directors, the outside accountants, and the lawyers sign these. So if they lie, they go to prison or they get fined huge amounts of money. So the only ones who lie anymore are people like Elon Musk. He got smacked, Tesla got smacked for tens of millions of dollars. What did Musk do? He got on Twitter and called them he called them dirty names. Really, Elon? You know, if I did that. Okay, let me look at Kellogg here. I'm going to pull up a really cool thing here. Now, I'll talk about this a lot later. But the 10K is an annual report. Now, you can actually download an Excel sheet. Every public company in the United States that is reporting to the SEC has to offer this massive Excel spreadsheet with every piece of financial information you could dream of. You download it, and it's all yours to make graphs, charts, whatever you want. And it's awesome because you can do research papers without actually typing in any numbers at all. Just use the spreadsheets and do what you want with them. But what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to look at the summaries here, the financial statements. I want to show you one here. The balance sheet. Nope. I hate it. There we go. Balance sheet. This is the accounting balance sheet. Now, if you remember from your dark, dark days in accounting, the balance sheet also has the total shareholders' equity. Now, remember, the shareholders' equity, the market says, is $25.304 billion. Let's see what the accountants say it is. Total equity, $3.72 billion. Those are the same thing, total shareholders' equity. The accountants say that it's $3.720 billion. The market right now says it's $25.304 billion. Do you notice that there's a little difference in their number? Now, which are you going to believe? Let me give you an example. Okay. You, madam, you have decided to take a safari out to the wilds of Africa, the Serengeti. Now, you've got your handy guidebook with you. and it opened it up, and now you see a lion coming at you. Your guidebook says, lions love people. They are very friendly. You can pet their bellies, and they'll purr for you. They're the sweetest animals on earth. You look up, and there's the lion coming at you. I shall eat your left buttock loin. What are you going to do? Are you going to tell her to run, or are you going to say, believe the book?
Run.
The market is going to drive you. You understand that? The market is where you're going to buy your stock. You're not going to buy, hello, accountant, I want to buy some stock from you. You're not going to do that. You're going to buy it from the market. You see, the accounting means nothing to us. That market is saying this company is worth $25.304 billion. Whatever the accountants say, well, we have to do it. That's required. That's the law. And the rules are god-awful, generally accepted accounting principles, consistently applied. That's the way they have to do it. But what that does is that gives them a number that is vastly different from the fire and shrapnel at the corner of Main and Fifth, where we trade every day. Let me show you another one. Let me do another one here for you. Let me try Google. Yeah, no, let's do Apple. Because we're right and they're wrong. That, well, more specifically, that's like we're saying it's 7-8 times the value that the accountants are saying. Now, that's significant. Let me do AAPL, and I'll give you a little more information about that. Apple. Let's look at Apple's financial statement. And we'll say, okay, financial statements, let's drive down here and get their balance sheet. The accountants say that Apple's total shareholder value is $63 billion. Now let's see what the market says it is, AAPL. The market says it's worth more than $2.5 trillion. Little difference there, isn't there? I got to convince you, whether you believe the accountants or you believe the market, you can't believe them both. They're way too different. We live by the accounting statements, and I always make fun of accountants, but they are the foundation of modern Western civilization, and I will tell you why that is. They are a powerhouse, and they make a lot of money for what they do because their lives are very exacting, precise, and tediously boring, but at the same time, they make more money than I do, which pisses me off. But at the same time, do you see that you can't take them both as the same truth? They are in different worlds. So you'll see this all the time. Now, here's how you think about it. What the accountants are doing is they're saying, okay, equity. You have your company sells stock, okay? So we count how many dollars came in for those sales of stock. And then over time, as the company lives its annual fiscal cycle, income is generated. Now we give some back to the shareholders, but the rest of it, we add to that money that we got from the stock. So in other words, this is a retained earning. Retained earnings beginning of the period plus whatever income minus dividends equals retained earnings at the end. And then we add to that when we sell stock, when the company sells some stock to raise money, that goes in there too. The market is, so in other words, okay, you, madam, you. No, I forgot I was talking to you. You're my daughter. No, don't kill yourself. It's okay. I had kids. I mean, they're messed up as hell, but, you know, they had me for a dad. Through your first 18 years, I put, let's say, $250,000 into you. That would be the accounting number. Now you come out, You're a junior executive. You're on your way. You've got a nice portfolio. You've got a home with increasing value. So if I took the present value of all that you are going to be and encapsulated that now, that's market cap. It's our assessment of what the present value of the company's future prospects is. So in other words, the $250,000 describes what I put in to create you. What you see there in the market capitalization, that's its technical name, is what we think is going to come out of that. So in other words, the larger the difference, as a matter of fact, we take a ratio of the market cap to the accounting, the book equity, and the bigger that multiple is, the more we see that the market sees as the market's ability to create from what was put in. So when we see an Apple with that kind of insane market cap divided by how much equity has been put in cash, we say apparently the market thinks this is some frickin' awesome company that has a present value of its future expected cash flows that is just staggering. Is that always correct? Well, it's what we do. We have to take our stand. We use the best math we can. And this is a lesson for all of you in this class and in any class you do. When you get out there, you use your best practices. You don't use your best guesses. You follow the best practices, what we all do, what we have learned how to do, what we from our education and from our experience. And if we're wrong, well, we did what was our best. That's what you're seeing there, the market's best assessment. With the hottest, smartest, fastest traders by the millions across the planet, they say Apple is worth $2.6 trillion. Are we right? Well, we'll find out, won't we, as time goes on. So taking all of that here aside, let me do one last thing. Notice, do you see how tight the bid-ask spread is on Apple? That's especially tight considering that those prices. Do you see how there's only a one penny bid-ask spread? That's because, look down here at the OBVs. Do you see how Apple is trading at about its normal, brisk, strong pace? So in other words, there is a lot of trading going on. That tends to tighten that bid-ask spread because I, as a trader, don't need to make a lot of coin off any given trade. I can just trust that I've got a huge volume, so all I need to do is make a penny. And I've got a plenty good day, and I've got a good meal, a steak, and a couple of martinis that evening. So that's what that is. Now, a couple of other things, just really quickly here. See that beta? That is a measure that is important to us, and I'll teach it all about it to you. It's a measure of the risk of the company. It is a professional's measure of risk. It's not an amateur's measure of risk. It's a professional's. This is the risk that you would bear in a well-diversified portfolio. You take any stock on its own, and its risk is insane. But if you have Apple in a well-diversified portfolio, it calms down and it has a risk of 1.23 beta. Now, a 1.00 beta is the fulcrum. Above 1.00 is risky. Below 1.00 is defensive. The farther it is on either side, the more it is of that side. So I'm looking at Apple here, and I say, actually, that's a kind of risky stock. That's a pretty risky. 1.23 is getting pretty noticeable on the risk side. On the other hand, if you look back there at Alphabet, Google, notice that it is not as risky. Look at Kellogg. That's a very conservative investment. See how its beta is well below one? That's kind of simple if you think about it, because Kellogg makes things that everyone needs. Cereal, you know, food. So, I mean, no matter what the economic times, you're still going to eat. And so those kinds of basic industries are going to tend to be a little less risky than the high-risk industries. On the other hand, companies, you can get into companies like AMD, American Micro Devices. 1.96. Yeah, that technically we say that's risky AF. That one is, I mean, simply because AMD is coming up against a Tyrannosaurus Rex called Intel, for God's sake. Let's look at Tesla. TSLA. Yeah, you got a company that's run by a baked ham, and I mean, baked day and night. I mean, yeah, it's risky AF. I mean, that's insanely risky. I mean, I pulled up one. I think it was NVIDIA a couple of years ago, and I think they've calmed down, but let me see real quick. NVDA. Yeah, they've calmed down quite a bit from how they were just ridiculous. Let me look at Uber. Yeah, that's risky. It's not as risky as I would have expected. But obviously, that's a volatile industry. They got a lot of problems. Uber has ups and downs in its earnings. That's a risky company. So this gives you an idea. Now, the next question that we come to here is kind of a simple one. And I'll start with someone like, you, madam, are you a risky person or a not risky person? You're probably right. Interestingly enough, younger people used to have high risk tolerance. You would see them aiming at portfolios that they didn't know they were doing it, obviously, but they were aiming at stocks. When you take the composite beta of the portfolio, it was well above one. Interestingly enough, in the last 15 years, 10 years, we have seen the average younger investor going more and more conservative, more and more defensive. Of course, in marketing, we make you feel like you're all wild and crazy. This is extreme because you're a wild and crazy person. You know, we're playing to that. We know that most younger people these days are quite afraid of drifting from the herd. And so we know that their portfolio decisions will tend to be more defensive. They don't stand out in the crowd. They don't want to, unless you're on TikTok and then you're weird. And even there, I mean, you know, but, huh? Yeah, I'm on TikTok. It's not a problem because I've met some real big fans, creepy people, though, you know. Anyway, the point there being that defensive is below one, aggressive is above one. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.